Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. We haven't been foreclosed upon. We're still in business. Kevin Pelton's my co-host from Basketball Perspectives. This is Ben from Blazers Edge. Kevin, you've got to be loving life right now. It's a great day, week to be a Rich Show fan, isn't it?
And, you know, I'm not a bandwagon jumper when it comes to being a Rich Cho fan. I mean, I feel like I knew Rich Cho back when there was probably about, like, maybe 50 of us in the world outside of the Sonics organization or outside of the NBA that, like, you know, were aware that they had this young up-and-coming guy who knew the cap inside and out, had a law degree, and was doing some statistical analysis. And I can vividly remember... This was back when I was doing a Sonics. It was essentially a blog. We didn't have the term blog. This was so long ago because it was like 2001-02. And going
so
to
it was
the
like
Sonics,
a moving web page of some sort.
It was just a fan site. That's all we had back then. Nothing as fancy as blog. But I went to the Sonics season ticket holder party, and everybody else wants to go see Gary Payton or Rashard Lewis or Desmond Mason or someone like that, Brent Barry. And who is Kevin Pelton excited to go talk to? Rich Cho, that's who. And I remember having a conversation with him about Dean Oliver and the work that he was doing for the Sonics. And this was so amazing back in 2002. And now, 8 years later, here we are, and Rich Cho is an NBA GM. This is awesome.
This really speaks to the risk that these guys took a little bit, going out on a limit and giving Cho this opportunity. I didn't know if Larry Miller was built like that. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, as the Blazers president, this is a guy who, you know, not in a negative way, but he's a pretty corporate guy. I mean, he plays by the rules. You know, he doesn't like to be out front. You know, he's a pretty discreet guy. Everything wants to be handled in silence. You know, he's kind of a by the book, you know, put in your work, honor your boss kind of guy. He's kind of putting himself out here a little bit to get Cho, isn't he? I mean, you know, some of the initial reaction, I think, before people started to get a feel for who Rich Cho was a little bit of disappointment from the Blazers. Like, they want Blazers fans, like, they wanted a bigger name. But once his bio starts to come out, I mean, it's hard not to fall in love with the guy. And do you think that's kind of what happened with Larry Miller and Paul Allen? They started to really get a sense for the depth of Rich's, you know, knowledge and his analytical skills and his intelligence. And they were just like, we can't pass on this guy. We don't care if people are going to have a backlash about it. We just got to make this move because this is the dude.
Well, I think a couple things. First off, you know, it was mentioned by Nate McMillan on the day that Cho was hired, and I've heard it from a bunch of people who worked with us in Seattle, and everyone is just thrilled for Rich Cho, by the way, who worked in Seattle. You know, they could not be more excited that he got this opportunity. But, you know, several of them have mentioned how they can see him and Paul Allen really hitting it off in terms of the way that Cho views the world and views basketball. It's a very analytical method that does rely on statistical analysis quite a bit, and how that fits, you know, Paul Allen's mindset and his vision. I think that they can speak a relatively common language, and I think that that definitely helped him. And the other thing is, I think that the Blazers knew that they could sell what you talked about in terms of Cho's resume, and I think that he's an easier hire in a place like Portland than, you know, maybe some other places where his kind of forward thinking wouldn't be viewed as such a positive. But, you know, especially among the Blazers fans who are really plugged in, I think they understand what Cho is going to bring to the table and why this hiring makes sense.
Okay, so I was going through, I don't know if you saw my piece, that, you know, hanging out with Cho on Monday afternoon or whatever. You know, the one area that I said that's going to be his biggest hurdle is going to be rallying the troops around him, you know, not necessarily the troops meaning the fans, but the troops being, you know, everyone who has to work these obscene hours during the season, everyone who has to buy into a vision of where the franchise is going, to kind of go above and beyond, to get all of his coworkers on the same page and rally around his personality, because it's not like he's just a friendly guy down the hall who knows the salary cap anymore. It's not even like he's the high-rising guy who you know is going to be a star in a couple of years. I mean, this is the guy now. This is the face of the franchise. It's a very youthful face. Sometimes it looks a little bit timid. You know, he's obviously very, very good at one-on-one interviews with the media. He was great one-on-one with fans. This is a guy who's got to step up and do some of the leadership-type things that Kevin Pritchard was so known for, the internal leadership. Do you see that as being a stumbling block for him? I mean, is there a situation in your mind where you can kind of think back to your time in Seattle and say, hey, I could imagine Rich Cho leading this really important meeting? Or is this all just from Hollywood stuff and that's not really that big of a deal? I mean, you got the inside perspective. You tell us how it really goes down.
I don't think it's a huge deal. I think the one thing that makes this situation unique and would, no matter who the Blazers hired to replace Kevin Pritchard, is that normally, you know, to be honest, when you're making a change in the front office, it's because of the fact that the team isn't very good. You know, when we had this kind of regime change in Seattle, it was after the team went 31-51, I guess, that year, and, you know, had missed the playoffs for the third straight season, and we all knew that something had to change. You know, Portland is a little bit of a different scenario where people are still a bit baffled as to why Kevin Pritchard is out. And, you know, I don't think that it's going to be as easy to sell that message of change. But, you know, I don't think that's going to be a huge stumbling block. I mean, I think when we come down to it, you know, what we've talked about is pretty evident that this is a big step up for Rich. He's never held a position like this before in terms of running the show. And, you know, that's going to mean adjustments for him in a number of different ways. You know, he talked about it at the press conference. I've never held a press conference before. He hasn't autographed kids before. I mean, these are just new situations for him. And I think so far he's handled himself very well in them. And I think that that's a good sign that that's going to continue in the future.
What did you think when you saw that picture I took of Cho autographing the back of a kid, the kid looking like it's the greatest day of his life? I mean, was that just like total like cognitive dissonance? Were you just like, what is going on right now?
Well, it's Blazers fans. I mean, what do you expect? I mean, then 2 days later, you have the photo of Wesley Matthews signing a kid's forehead. So,
so let's get into, you know, this analytical approach to evaluating basketball talent, right? Everyone's been talking about it. It gets this generic term. I don't think anyone knows the analytical side better than you, and then by whatever osmosis I've been able to steal. I mean, that's kind of what we do, right? We get this analytical approach to evaluating talent. Now, Cho seemed a little bit touchy about it. He didn't want people just to think it was only numbers. He wanted people to go back to that eyes, ears, numbers, three-part criteria. What's your feel for really his approach? I mean, how does it play out on a day-by-day basis? So let's say, you know, they have a do-over and chose the GM before they make the Wesley Matthews offer. How do you think his mind is working going into preparing that offer? What's he looking at? What are his criteria? Can you just give us, you know, your best guess, I guess? You know, and obviously you're not speaking for him, but how does his mind work when he's evaluating that kind of a big decision? Because and that was the biggest decision they really had of the summer so far, as to how to spend that MLE. Now they've done it. You know, now the decisions are totally different for him. But how do you think he would maybe have approached that?
Well, I would say first off that I think it's understandable that no one wants to get stereotyped as, oh, he's just a stat guy or something like that. And, you know, especially because Rich's background, non-player evaluation, but that's something that he's done a lot more of the last couple of years. And I think he wants to, you know, not let that get overwhelmed by the other side of it. You know, I mean, I think that was an issue even when Sam Presti was hired in Seattle, despite the fact that he had some great scouting triumphs in terms of his role in Tony Parker's selection and things like that. And I think also it's an honest perspective. I mean, there is no one who would rise to a position like this who is going to say, hey, let's only look at the stats and ignore everything else or anything even remotely like that. I mean, you know, there's great respect within the analytical community for the scouting process and how important it is and how you have to kind of complement that with the analysis you do. But I think one really good point that Rich made, I think, to you was that analytical doesn't necessarily just mean looking at statistics. It's also a way of approaching things and a way of just viewing decisions. So he talked about, you know, the research that goes into signing second-round draft picks and looking at contracts that have been signed in the past and using history. So if you talk about the Wesley Matthews decision in particular, you know, I suspect that one of the things he might have done is look at the history of long-term contracts in that vein, which, you know, not...
So wait, hold on. So... Hold on. What you're saying is he would have just read Basketball Prospectus. I mean, are you saying if Larry Miller had read Basketball Prospectus, then maybe we wouldn't have been in a situation where they just gave Wes Matthews 5 years, 35? Is that what you're telling me, KP?
I'm saying that I think that in that particular instance, his mind might have gone to a similar place in terms of looking at not only long-term contracts, but the history of the mid-level exception and offers like this, which just happen to be things that have interested me and that I've written about. And am I going to definitively say that if Rich was running the show, he wouldn't have made the offer that they did to Wesley Matthews? No, I mean, I think that clearly the front office understands that, yes, we're paying a premium for Wesley Matthews, but I think that first they view it as a necessary overpaying to get a restricted free agent away from a division rival, no less. And also, I think they view it as less of a risk because of what they know about Wesley Matthews as a character and who he is as a person, as a player. Now, that's a case where I think, again, the research kind of tends to contradict it. That it's not so much specifically about, you know, the risk of a player slacking off once they have a long-term contract or something like that. It's just the risk that's inherent to signing guys and trying to figure out what they're going to be in 5 years because of injuries and all sorts of different factors.
Well, you make good points. What did you, and I know this is probably your favorite part of that piece, that show piece, but you know, his little shout out for APBR metrics, you just give people maybe who aren't as hardcore nerdy as you are, or, you know, I am, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean to you when on day one, an NBA GM is shouting out APBR metrics, and, you know, what is that? And why would he?
Well, there's a certain street cred among statistical analysts. I think Nick Collison has vouched for my own particular street cred on Twitter. And, you know, there's a lingo you talk, and APBR metrics indicates that, yeah, I know what I'm talking about because that's the term that the community has given itself, and along the lines of sabermetrics in baseball to explain what we're doing. And, you got to be paying attention to know the term APBR metrics.
What is it? I mean, pull the veil back. I mean, is this like a Freemason society? I mean, how many people are we talking about? Who's running the show? Who coined the term? I mean, we need some history here because, look, we're trying to rally around Rich Cho here in Portland. We're trying to say, hey, Kevin Pritchard, I mean, we're basically, for Blazers fans, a god is being replaced, right? So we've got to build a new god here in Rich Cho, and his foundational, you know, Stonehenge foundation is going to be the numbers and the APBR metrics stuff, right? So we need to know as much as possible about it. How does it come up so early? Why does it come up so early? And, you know, who's behind it? I mean, is it something that people should be afraid of? I mean, we got to embrace this with open arms, KP. You got to do a real good sell job here on why people should be pumped about APBR metrics. This is like a defining moment, isn't it?
Well, I would hope even if they don't know the term APBR metrics, that Wingcast listeners know already that it's not something to be feared. It's possibly something to be joked about. I don't know. But some of these answers are kind of self-serving because the term was kind of floating around out there. There was a few of them, and I think that I actually served to basically, you know, codify it as the term for the community because of the fact that I started this new message board for the group of people discussing basketball stats online.
Wait. So hold on. So what you're saying is, Rich Cho's personally shouting you out, and it's day one. Is that what's happening?
That's not how he's thinking of it.
That's how we're going to spin it, right? That's how we're going to spin it, so people will keep listening to this, right?
Yes. So I started this message board, and that's kind of the central hub of the statistical analysis community, where, you know, we've had all sorts of people from Dean Oliver, John Hollinger, Dan Rosenbaum, people who, you know, various, not many NBA insiders post because of the fact that it's difficult for them to say very much without, you know, giving away what they're doing. And that's the number one fear of people within the league is, you know, that everyone else is going to figure out their proprietary methods. But definitely there are people within the league that read it, and then people who have started posting there, that's like kind of been their entry into the NBA, who are now working as consultants to teams, including a couple of guys who work for the Blazers, for that matter.
So how gratifying is it? I mean, you must be on cloud nine, not just because you know the guy personally, but just because this is like a validation of like 7 years of mom's basement activities, right?
Well, I think the big thing is not so much that Rich Cho's interest is the way that the Blazers have positioned this is one of the strengths that makes Rich Cho a good hire. And that's something that would have been impossible to imagine even a couple of years ago, I think. You know, the success that the Blazers have enjoyed with in terms of using statistical analysis, obviously the Rockets with Daryl Morey, you know, Sam Presti being connected with it in Oklahoma City, it's made this not only a valid thing, but in some ways a hip thing where among, you know, a certain segment of hardcore fans, you're considered behind the times if you're not using statistical analysis.
Got it. Hey, so let's enough of giving you your victory lap, you know, because I mean, that was fun. And I think it was totally necessary. I mean, really, I'm surprised that you actually, now I know why you've been bugging me to do a Wingcast all week, because that probably felt really good to get a little shine, you know, get out there and get your suntan on a little bit. But let's talk about what he needs to do going forward here. Who's going to be his assistant? What does he need? You know, I asked him, he kind of generically said, hey, I need somebody who's experienced, right? Well, he didn't want to go into what areas of experience. You know, and last night on TV, they suggested, hey, maybe it should be someone, you know, who has experience relating to players, maybe even an ex-player. So you've got, you know, a little credibility built up, you know, that relationship between the roster and the management level would be tight. You know, I made the argument that, like you said earlier, you know, he's got Nate McMillan kind of co-signing him. So, you know, I don't think his credibility is in question a ton with this current roster, but maybe going forward, maybe to attract free agents, it would be helpful to have that kind of a voice. What kind of person do you see, you know, Cho wanting to put into that secondary role next to him? What skills, you know, is he lacking? You know, you definitely, you know, if you're going to say media is his weakest skill, I don't think you really want to necessarily hire a real media savvy assistant GM, do you? Because then all of a sudden you've got this really awkward tension of, you know, who's this guy? You know, why is he in front? Why isn't Cho talking? You know, I don't think you want to necessarily go that route. But in terms of, you know, the hardcore basketball stuff, what is he going to want help on? What is he going to want assistance on? Do you have any names in mind?
I don't know if I have any names in mind. Someone asked me about that yesterday. And, you know, one of the interesting things is I'm not sure that there's anybody that he worked with in Seattle that would kind of make sense really to me. A lot of those people who were in the organization in scouting roles and everything are actually now working for Rick Sund in Atlanta. He took a lot of that same operation down there when he was hired by the Hawks. So, you know, that's a little difficult. I'm not sure that there's anyone from the Thunder even that really makes sense. I would say, to me, the biggest need, you know, you're looking at this assistant GM to complement your skill set. So when we look at where Rich is weaker, I think one area is talent evaluation, naturally. But I think the Blazers feel like they have that covered pretty well with Mike Bourne and Chad Buchanan and their ability to scout. And, you know, obviously they were a priority, which is why they got extended before the Kevin Pritchard move went down and why they've been helping the show the last couple of weeks here. So I would say the biggest single factor that he's missing is just kind of the experience of being a GM and making those kind of big picture decisions. You know, that's another area I think where Kevin Pritchard was a strength, you know, that was a strength of his, and that we just don't know whether it's going to be a strength of Cho's or not, because he doesn't have that experience of having to make the final call. So I would say if there's someone you could hire who has experience as a general manager but is in a position of their career right now where they don't necessarily want to be a GM again, they're content serving that sort of mentorship role, you know, basically the front office equivalent of a Bernie Bickerstaff, quite frankly. You know, someone who has that experience, who's been in the trenches, but right now is content playing an assistant role. So I don't know if I have any specific names that fit that, but that's the general template in my mind.
No, I like what you're thinking. What if I play devil's advocate? What if I go the other way and I say, you know what, these dudes should just assemble like the dream team of brains, bring in David Griffin from Phoenix as the assistant. It's not going to be a promotion maybe, but you pay him a bunch. You let him know he's going to be involved in all the key decisions. You know, he's going to be working for a much more supportive owner with all sorts of more flexibility to do what he does best. What if you bring that guy in and you just have the dream team of young heads? How awesome would that be?
I think that's a very compelling argument. Now, Griffin is a Warren Legere guy. Is there any chance that the Blazers are going to hire him even in a non-general manager position?
Ooh, that's a good point. You know, it's so awkward, man. I tell you, I was down in Vegas for the whole week, right? I didn't see Warren and Larry Miller in the same room at the same time. And, you know, it's Vegas. There's not that many rooms. There's like two or three rooms you could possibly be in. And, you know, I didn't see Larry a ton. First of all, I guess he was obviously doing interviews, and he came back a little bit early, he said. But, yeah, I think there's some pretty serious animosity there between those two sides. I don't think that's any real breaking news. But, you know, can you let bygones be bygones now that you've got your guy? If Griffin doesn't have a spot, does maybe he start to think, hey, you know, I want to stay in the NBA? Because he kind of left abruptly. People thought maybe he had an out plan. It turns out he didn't really have an out plan, you know? I mean, he's been sitting open for a while. He's been getting some interviews, but, you know, not too much. I think that'd be awesome, personally. I mean, I think if you go back 12 months and you say, okay, we've got Kevin Pritchard and Tom Penn in place, but going forward 12 months, all of a sudden you can't have either one of those guys. You know, who are the two that you want to replace them? You can have your pick of anyone that's not currently a GM. I mean, the top two I would pick would be Rich Cho and David Griffin. And another guy to keep an eye on, I think, would be Jason Levien from Sacramento. I mean, the problem there is he wants his own job, and I think he's got a ton of clout, so he's probably not going to come in as an assistant. But I think that's another guy who I'm surprised he hasn't been picked up by one of these teams that needs a GM. So I feel like that guy's a real high riser, real quick riser, smart guy, gets the player side intimately because he's the former agent, real shrewd. You know, he's picked off assets before. He got Sergio plus money for practically nothing. I mean, I think that'd be a guy I would look at too. Probably not a fit here, but I do think he's another bright young mind if we're talking those guys.
All good points, and it's interesting that with Phoenix going in that kind of direction of hiring an agent to run the front office, that they went with Lon Babby as opposed to Levien, you know, who actually has some relevant front office experience at this point. But the other aspect is there's still a bit of this summer to shake out. You still have who Phoenix is going to hire is their talent evaluator and their right-hand man for Lon Babby. Golden State, depending on how quickly this sale gets approved to their new owners, we could see a shakeup in their front office. So there's still some things to be settled.
Word. Anything else on Cho that we haven't talked about, Kayfee? I mean, do you think – I guess here's the thing. Let's put it into some context. Did the Blazers succeed? And this was kind of my argument at the very end of the piece. Probably didn't get there. It's too long. You know, your pictures probably distracts you. My argument is – you know, there's some open questions about Cho, and I think we've raised some of them here today. My argument is they needed a guy who could really help turn the page, could get some excitement back. And to me personally, watching him, you know, hang out with all those fans, watching just how he carried himself, how he talked, how he presents himself, how intelligent he obviously is, I think they found that guy. I think they were able to turn the page here, and it was, you know, a tough sell, you know, because he didn't have a huge profile here outside of, you know, a small community. And I think he ended up being that guy who was going to be able to you know, maybe not step into Kevin Pritchard's shoes, but maybe, you know, get the ball rolling in a different direction so that people can put all the ugliness behind them. Because I think if I've heard anything over the last couple months, it's been people are sick and tired of the drama. They don't want to know about the organizational politics. It's just overload. They want to move on. They want someone who's going to be, you know, have the house in order. And I think people see Cho as that guy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And if you want to talk about someone who isn't going to, you know, to the extent that if anyone thought that Kevin Pritchard didn't divide credit and share it and do that sort of things and wasn't, you know, perhaps a team player or whatever the criticism was, Rich Cho is going to be that guy. And I think the other aspect of it is if you hired someone with a similar background to Pritchard where they were maybe a former player or, you know, had made their name in scouting or something like that, you know, they're going to be more inevitably compared to Pritchard. It's like, why are we hiring a lesser version of the guy we already had? Whereas by going in a slightly different direction and hiring Cho, I think it was easier to get people excited about the things the new things that he was going to bring to the table.
No question. So should we talk about Wesley Matthews?
Sure.
We've already hit on it a little bit, but so let's just say, first of all, I mean, this guy's got an incredible personality. I think everybody has gotten that. Like, you know, is it worth $34 million for a bright smile, a great attitude, and a hard worker? I mean, I don't know, but that you're getting that, and there's no questions asked about that. You know, let's talk about the piece that you wrote about, and you mentioned it earlier about the long-term contracts. Can you just give me an idea numbers-wise? And I was talking to a couple of people at his press conference, you know, about where people thought that contract should be. You know, Kelly Dwyer wrote something like 2 years, $10 million. Basically, the Rajah Bell deal that Utah gave, that's what should have been given to Matthews. That would have been around a fair amount. I think given where Matthews is experience-wise, age-wise, I think you could probably make an argument that he deserves maybe 3 or 4 years. Maybe you throw in a player option or a team option, something like that, if you're going to go to the four-year deal. But then you talk to the Blazers scouts, and they're just like, "Look, this—we value this guy. We don't—I mean, we don't care if we overpaid. We paid exactly what we had to do to give us the best possible chance of getting him, and we got him. We have absolutely no regrets." And that's going back a full week. I mean, I've been like basically on these guys for a week. Like, did you overpay? Did you overpay? Did you overpay? And they just outright shoot me down every single time. They're like, "Absolutely not." So let's put it this way: what do you think the lowest amount of money that the Blazers could have spent to get Wesley Matthews away from Utah? Do you have a number in mind there? And then how would you have ideally structured this contract so that the Blazers could get him, but also they're not committing maybe to that full 5 years, which you pointed out on Basketball Prospectus is kind of a risky proposition when you're talking about a player in Matthews' situation, or really any player who you're looking to spend your entire mid-level on?
Well, yeah. I think first off, I think Kelly said 3-10, 3 years, $10 million, and I think that's probably about where my mind would go too. You know, this is a guy who, it was a mistake that he went undrafted. He clearly showed that last season, but is he an average NBA player? I don't know, outside of Utah's system. I mean, he was a very effective and capable starter last year for the Jazz. Let's be clear on that. And he's got a couple of skills that are very good for a role player to have in terms of A, shooting the basketball, and B, being an above-average defender. You know, I don't know that he's an elite defender, and I think that he's sometimes been portrayed as that. Is he going to be a better defender than Nicholas Batum on the wing? No, I don't think so. So, you know, and then what the long contract piece basically got at, for those people who didn't read it, is the years is in many ways more important than the money, because of the fact that no matter who you sign, there's a significant, significant risk that the player will not be the same, you know, 4 years, 5 years down the road. So, I mean, I think if I'm talking about one particular modification to make this deal more palatable for the Blazers, I think that the length wasn't really a huge factor necessarily for the Jazz, because from their perspective, their primary concern is how do we avoid paying the luxury tax, or minimize the amount of luxury tax that we're going to pay this year. So from that perspective, Wesley Matthews' contract, whatever it was next year, doubles. So he's a $10 million player for them if they match that contract. But after Andrei Kirilenko's contract expires and a few years down the road, you know, they're going to probably have their salary structure set up a little better so that they're not paying the luxury tax. So I don't know that what they're paying in year five is really a major driver of that decision for Utah. So I think what making a five-year contract allowed the Blazers to do was to front-load it more in terms of the bonus, because that's driven in part, I mean, I'm getting a little out of my level of expertise on the CBA here, but I don't think that they could have front-loaded it quite as heavily in terms of the initial signing bonus if it's only a three-year deal. So I don't know if there's a way to make that, you know, partial guarantees in years four and five, so you've still got that five-year front-loaded contract, but it's not as risky for the Blazers, or whether they could have just done, you know, a three-year mid-level deal and Utah wouldn't match that either.
Would KP have made that deal? Would KP have made that offer if he was still here?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, he
that,
had
that tells
made
you that, that hesitation right there tells you everything you know. He wouldn't have made that deal. There's no way. Unless you can come and say yes, I don't think there's any way that Kevin Pritchard makes that deal. And that's what makes this so fascinating, the situation. It's like, okay, the old guy wouldn't have done it. We had this like 3 or 4 week window where there wasn't a new guy. Larry Miller just decides, hey, I'm going to spend the coolest chip that we have in the summer, and the scouts co-sign it completely, so we're good. And then the new guy comes in and has to deal with that. I mean, that is just – I mean, that's Hollywood drama, isn't it?
Well, I don't think – I hope it's going to be no drama. But, yeah, I don't know that either the old guy or the new guy would have done the deal. So it's awkward from that perspective.
But we should give Cho credit for standing up for the deal after the fact. I mean, he didn't have a choice there, but when I asked him about it on Monday, I thought his answer was pretty interesting. You know, he went through, here's what Matt, you know, he made the best case you could possibly make for Matthews. He made a very Cho case for Matthews, you know, which included stats, shot charts, age, injury history, all these things, you know, he's throwing them in together to kind of make an argument for why it wasn't that bad of a deal. But we're never going to know the truth about whether he would have done it or not. But I think that deal raised a lot of eyebrows. Although I was glad to see that when people were ranking the best and worst deals, actually Tom Habestraw, one of your buddies on ESPN Insider, was ranking the best and worst deals. Matthews didn't have the worst two-guard deal. Thank God Joe Johnson's out there.
he was merely honorable mention, yes. I mean, I think the one question we probably want to touch on is, you know, there's a certain segment of Blazers fans, and Casey voiced this on trailblazers.com yesterday, that's like, why is it a big deal that we're overpaying? It's not our money. And, I can understand that perspective, but I just think there's such a value in the modern NBA to maintaining flexibility and having options. There's always an alternative cost to anything you're going to do. And in some case, at the extreme, it becomes, if things go really south and injuries are involved, Wesley Matthews isn't worth a roster spot in year four or year five. So, you know, by having him with his guaranteed contract, unless you're willing to just eat it, then you're costing yourself the chance to have a better player potentially on the roster. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that's the worst case scenario. And I think the odd thing is that really, if there's anyone that should have learned this lesson, it is the Blazers, because this was kind of the failure of the Bob Whitsitt philosophy of, we're going to spend the mid-level every year because we have more money than anyone else to spend. We don't care about the luxury tax, so we're going to keep bringing in Reuben Patterson and Derek Anderson and guys like that at the mid-level. And eventually it just became a disaster because he had all these long-term contracts and nothing he could do with them besides shuffle them for another bad long-term contract. I mean, now the upside of Wesley Matthews is he's a great citizen and you don't have to worry about him in the same way that you would a Reuben Patterson or a lot of the other guys Whitsitt brought in. But in basketball terms, there's the same potential for lack of flexibility. And I think that's something that Kevin Pritchard really was a hallmark of his time as general manager. You know, he specifically was trying to get under the cap, but he also was thinking long-term in terms of maintaining that flexibility.
Yeah, I think there's some real flexibility issues here. And not only flexibility issues, I don't think that I've really pumped this angle enough, and I should. What message did you just tell Greg Oden about his value to your organization? If Wesley Matthews is worth 35 over 5, he's never played a game for you, he's only been a rookie, he's only played one season, he's produced well in the playoffs, but certainly he's not blowing anyone away. And then, and he was undrafted, and then you're entering negotiations with your number one draft pick, who's played as many games as Wesley Matthews has played in his NBA career, although it was stretched over 3 seasons. He's put up astronomically near all-star numbers, especially per minute, when the games that he has played. He's been a centerpiece of all of your marketing efforts. He's got a reason to be committed to Portland. He's got Portland fans already committed to him in a way that Wesley Matthews doesn't. You've got all these things tied up in Greg Oden. I mean, what's Greg Oden worth now? A max? I mean, are you just going to throw $85 million at this guy? I mean, what are you going to do? Like, you're really kind of painting yourself into a corner when you pay a backup shooting guard, and a perennial backup, that money, and then you've got to turn to Greg Oden, who's going to be your franchise center, supposedly, or at least your starting center, depending on how things shake out with his injuries, and say, hey, Greg, you know, we want you to go for 50. I mean, that's not going to fly. You're going to have to go much higher than that. Or do you think I'm crazy? Am I completely off base? I mean, that was the first thing I thought when I saw 35. I was like, oh, God, what does this mean for the Greg Oden deal?
I mean, I still think that Greg is going to be – his extension is going to be negotiated primarily on the basis of LaMarcus Aldridge's extension. I think that's going to be the number one comparable that, you know, both sides are going to use as probably not necessarily a starting point, but just where they're going to set the bar, so to speak. But, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's a salary structure – at play within an NBA team. And, you know, I think this can get overplayed sometimes, but it's best to have guys making money that they know that they should make. And when they look around the locker room, you know, they understand their value in a relative sense. You also see this a couple of years down the line with Nicholas Batum's extension in terms of, you know, I'm the starting small forward. This guy is a backup 2-3, you know.
Yep.
What am I worth now? So, yeah, I think that's definitely a factor. And if you're talking about big decisions for Rich Joe entering the job, you know, there's a lot of talk about what's going to be his first big decision. Will it be a trade, consolidating some talent in the backcourt now that we have all these young guys, something like that? Well, the first really, really big decision, unless, you know, something happens with Chris Paul, which I don't think it is, is going to be the Grey Gardner extension, and having Rich Cho come in with a fresh perspective and a new set of eyes and not the same investment in Grey Gardner's regime, that's going to be really interesting to watch play out.
Well, you know, the other first possible move obviously could maybe just be him dumping Wesley Matthews' contract. Just kidding. That'd be awesome, though, wouldn't it?
Well, let's talk real quickly about Wesley Matthews and how he fits into the lineup. I mean, where do you see him getting his minutes? Do you see Brandon Roy potentially shifting to the point guard at times to make room for him when you want him, when you're coming up against perhaps a team with two good wing scorers and you want Batum and Matthews both in there defensively? How does that play out? Where does he carve out those minutes?
The only way that Brandon Roy will ever take over point guard duties on offense is if Nate McMillan commits to playing Nicholas Batum defensively on other teams' point guards. So that's going to be a matchup type situation. Is there the possibility that they could use Brandon, Wesley, and Nick together, especially late in games with Nick guarding the point guard? I absolutely think so. I think Matthews can guard that three. I think he can guard the bigger twos, you know, the high scores. I think you've basically just, you know, removed any defensive responsibility from Brandon Roy's life at this point. I think, you know, he takes whoever the third best guard player on offense is when Brandon's playing defense, and he just kind of gets to relax, and Nick and Matthews handle the matchups when they play together. You know, I think still some of it's to be determined whether they move Andre or not. There's been a lot of chatter behind the scenes about Andre getting moved. So I think that that's still kind of an open question. But I think to start, Matthews is going to pencil in as that backup too. I think he's going to play pretty heavy minutes. I think they're going to try to limit Brandon's minutes a little bit more than they did last year. I think he's going to play primarily at 2 and 3. And then, you know, situationally, you get him in there with Brandon and Nick at the same time, and you have a pretty devastating lineup. I mean, that's an awesome lineup. I mean, we used to joke about, what did I call it, the pterodactyl lineup, when they put out all the long athletic guys all at the same time with, like, LaMarcus and Dante and Nick simultaneously. You put Brandon, Wes Matthews, and Nick in the backcourt together, and that's a tough matchup for a lot of teams. That's not somebody that I necessarily would want to go against, you know, even in a 7-game series. I mean, I feel like that has a lot of potential in the playoffs. So I think that's probably how he's going to fit in. Do you have a different read, or?
No, I think that's a good point. You know, and the team I compare it to in my head as I'm thinking about this is actually something that none of your readers, listeners are probably going to know. It's the New York Liberty in the WNBA, where they have Cappy Pondexter as sort of a
Wait, hold on. Hold on, slow down. This is David Kahn. I'm going to have to go Chris Webber on you. You're gonna put the Portland Trailblazers in the same sentence as the New York Liberty. Don't go there.
Yeah, I'll put Cappy Pondexter in the same sentence as Brandon Roy. She's a phenomenal talent, and they move her to the point down the stretch sometimes and put in a bigger defensive specialist that they have who's a rookie. So it's actually a fairly similar situation, except they don't have a Nicholas Batum. So.
Well, there you go. Well, I don't think anyone knows what you just said. I think all of a sudden you just started speaking a different language there for like 30 seconds. KP, I tried to give the WNBA love last summer, and you know how that worked out.
Well, you know, now is the time, the Seattle Storm, 19-2, if you want to jump on the bandwagon.
Jeez, 19-2?
Just
that's
crushing
like
opponents.
96 Bulls numbers, that's awesome.
All right, KP,
it was an enjoyable. I'm not sure if this was a podcast or, like I said earlier, a victory lap. Kind of feels good. I feel like this is about as exciting as it gets during the middle of the summer. We're about to head into a dog days of August, I think, where it's going to get pretty slow, but nice to close July on a good note, isn't it?
It definitely is, and it's nice to have a sense of, you know, knowing the direction after not knowing the direction for probably a few months there, basically, since Tom Penn was fired.
No doubt. All right, KP, it's good to get back on the air with you. We'll keep doing this, you know, as the season gets closer. And you got a new book coming out this fall, right?
Yeah, we're just starting work now. The Shaney projection system is starting to take shape. I don't have any team projections to give you yet, but I look forward to sharing a few of those and teasing what's going to be in the book this fall.
All right, just remember, no hyphens. Talk to you later.
Later. I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake.
But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, bro, entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer. Come streets.